Manhattan these days. Burley speaks of the estate of stockholding as being, by its nature, passive-receptive, rather than managing and creating. Most of the AT&T stockholders in Detroit, it seemed to me, were so deeply devoted to the notion of the company as Santa Claus that they went beyond passive receptivity to active cupboard love. And the professional stockholders, I felt, had taken on an assignment almost as thankless as that of recruiting for the Young Communist League among the junior executives of the Chase Manhattan Bank. In view of Chairman Filippi's warning to General Electric stockholders at Schenectady in 1965, and of the report about the company's hardline task force, it was with a sense of being engaged in hot pursuit that I boarded a southbound Pullman for the General Electric annual meeting. This one was held in Atlanta's Municipal Auditorium, a snappy hall, the rear of which was brightened by an interior garden complete with trees and a lawn. And in spite of the fact that it was held on a languorous, rainy, southern spring morning, more than 1,000 GE stockholders turned out. As far as I could see, 3 of them were Negroes. And it was not long before I saw that another of them was Mrs. Soss. However exasperated he may have become the previous year in Schenectady, Mr. Filippi, who also conducted the 1966 meeting, was in perfect control of himself and of the situation this time around. Whether he was expatiating on the wonders of GE's balance sheet and its laboratory discoveries, or sparring with the professional stockholders, he spoke in the same sing-song way, delicately treading the thin line between patient, careful exposition and irony. Mr. Saxon, in his Harvard Business Review article, had written, "Top executives are finding it necessary to learn how to lessen the adverse impact of the few disruptors on the majority of shareowners, while simultaneously enhancing the positive effects of the good things which do take place in the annual meeting." And having learned sometime earlier that the same Mr. Saxon had been engaged by GE as an advisor on stockholder relations, I couldn't help suspecting that Mr. Filippi's performance was a demonstration of Saxonism in action. The professional stockholders, for their part, responded by adopting precisely the same ambiguous style, and the resulting dialogue had the general air of a conversation between two people who have quarreled and then decided, not quite wholeheartedly, to make it up. The professional stockholders might have demanded to know how much money GE had spent in the interest of keeping them under control, but they missed the chance. One of the exchanges, in this vein, achieved a touch of wit. Mrs. Soss, speaking in her sweetest tone, called attention to the fact that one of the board of directors' candidates, Frederick L. Hovde, president of Purdue University and former chairman of the Army Scientific Advisory Panel, owned only 10 shares of GE stock, and said she felt that the board should be made up of more substantial holders. Whereupon, Mr. Filippi pointed out, just as sweetly, that the company had many thousands of holders of 10 or fewer shares, Mrs. Soss among them, and suggested that perhaps these small holders were deserving of representation on the board by one of their number. Mrs. Soss had to concede a fine stroke of chairmanship, and she did. On another matter, although decorum was stringently maintained by both sides, outward accord was less complete. Several stockholders, Mrs. Soss among them, had formally proposed that the company adopt for its director elections the system called cumulative voting, under which a stockholder may concentrate all the votes he is entitled to on a single candidate rather than spread them over the whole slate, and which therefore gives a minority group of stockholders a much better chance of electing one representative to the board. Cumulative voting, though a subject of controversy in big business circles, for obvious reasons, is nevertheless a perfectly respectable idea. Indeed, it is mandatory for companies incorporated in more than 20 states, and it is used by some 400 companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Nevertheless, Mr. Filippi did not find it necessary to answer Mrs. Soss's argument for cumulative voting. He chose instead to stand on a brief company statement on this subject that had been previously mailed out to stockholders, the main point of which was that the presence on the GE board, as a result of cumulative voting of representatives of special interest groups, might have a divisive and disruptive effect. Of course, Mr. Filippi did not say he knew, as he doubtless did know, that the company had in hand more than enough proxies to defeat the proposal. Some companies, like some animals, have their private, highly specialized gadflies, who harass them and nobody else. And General Electric is one. In this instance, the gadfly was Louis A. Brusati of Chicago, who, at the company's meetings over the past 13 years, had advanced 31 proposals, all of which had been defeated by a vote of at least 97% to 3%. In Atlanta, Mr. Brusati, a gray-haired man built like a football player, was at it again. Not with proposals this time, but with questions. For one thing, he wanted to know why Mr. Filippi's personal holdings of GE stock, listed in the proxy statement, now were 423 shares, fewer than they had been a year ago. Mr. Filippi replied that the difference represented shares that he had contributed to family trust funds, and added mildly but with emphasis, "I could say it's none of your business. I believe I have a right to the privacy of my affairs." There was more reason for the mildness than for the emphasis, as Mr. Brusati did not fail to point out, in an impeccably unemotional monotone. Many of Mr. Filippi's shares had been acquired under options at preferential prices, not available to others, and moreover, the fact that Mr. Filippi's precise holdings had been included in the proxy statement clearly showed that in the opinion of the Securities and Exchange Commission, his holdings were Mr. Brusati's business. Going on to the matter of the fees paid directors, Mr. Brusati elicited from Mr. Filippi the information that over the past 7 years, these had been raised from $2,500 per annum first to $5,000 and then to $7,500. The ensuing dialogue between the two men went like this. "By the way, who establishes those fees?" "Those fees are established by the board of directors."
"The board of directors establish their own fees?"
"Yes."
"Thank you."
"Thank you, Mr. Brusati." Later on in the morning, there were several lengthy and eloquent orations by stockholders on the virtues of General Electric and of the South. But this rather elegantly elliptical exchange between Mr. Brusati and Mr. Filippi stuck in my mind, for it seemed to sum up the spirit of the meeting. Only after adjournment, which came at 12:30, following Mr. Filippi's announcement that the unopposed slate of directors had been elected and that cumulative voting had lost by 97.51% to 2.49%, did I realize that not only had there been no stamping, booing, or shouting, as there had been in Detroit, but regional pride had not had to be invoked against the professional stockholders. It had been General Electric's whole card, I felt, but General Electric had won on the board, without needing to turn it up. Each meeting I attended had its easily discernible characteristic tone, and that of Charles Fizer and Company, the diversified pharmaceutical and chemical firm, was amicability. Pfizer, which in previous years had customarily held its annual meeting at its headquarters in Brooklyn, reversed the trend by moving this year's meeting right into the lair of the most vocal dissenters, Midtown Manhattan. But everything that I saw and heard convinced me that the motivation behind this move had been not a brash resolve on the company's part to beard the lions in their den, but a highly unfashionable desire to get the maximum possible turnout. Pfizer seemed to feel self-confident enough to meet its stockholders with its guard down. For instance, in contrast with the other meetings I attended, no stockholder tickets were collected or credentials checked at the entrance to the grand ballroom of the Commodore Hotel, where the Pfizer meeting was held. Fidel Castro himself, whose oratorical style I have occasionally felt that the professional stockholders were using as a model could presumably have walked in and said whatever he chose. Some 1,700 persons, or nearly enough to fill the ballroom, showed up, and all the members of the Pfizer board of directors sat on the platform from start to finish and answered any questions addressed to them individually. Speaking appropriately with a faint trace of a Brooklyn accent, Chairman John E. McKean welcomed the stockholders as my dear and cherished friends. I tried to imagine Mr. Kappel and Mr. Filippi addressing their stockholders that way, and couldn't, but then their companies are bigger, and said that on the way out, everyone present would be given a big free sample kit of Pfizer consumer products, such as Barbasol, Desitin, and Imprevu. Wooed thus by endearments and the promise of gifts, and further softened up by the report of President John J. Powers, Jr. on current operations, records all around, and immediate prospects, more records expected, the most intransigent professional stockholder would have been hard put to it to mount much of a rebellion at this particular meeting, and, as it happened, the only professional present seemed to be John Gilbert, brother of Lewis. I learned later that Lewis Gilbert and Mrs. Davis were in Cleveland that day, attending the U.S. Steel meeting. John Gilbert is the sort of professional stockholder the Pfizer management deserves, or would like to think it does, with an easygoing manner, in a habit of punctuating his words with self-deprecating little laughs, he is the most ingratiating gadfly imaginable, or was on this occasion. I'm told he isn't always. And as he ran through what seemed to be the standard Gilbert family repertoire of questions, on the reliability of the firm's auditors, the salaries of its officers, the fees of its directors, he seemed almost apologetic that duty called on him to commit the indelicacy of asking such things. As for the amateur stockholders present, their questions and comments were about like those at the other meetings I'd attended, but this time their attitude toward the role of the professional stockholder was noticeably different. Instead of being overwhelmingly opposed, they appeared to be split. To judge from the volume of clapping and of discreet groaning, about half of those present considered Gilbert a nuisance and half considered him a help. Powers left no doubt about how he felt. Before adjourning the meeting, he said, without irony, that he had welcomed Gilbert's questions and made a point of inviting him to come again next year. And, indeed, during the later stages of the Pfizer meeting, when Gilbert, in a conversational way, was praising the company for some things and criticizing it for others, and the various members of the board were replying to his comments just as informally, I got for the first time a fleeting sense of genuine communication between stockholders and managers. The Radio Corporation of America, which had held its last two meetings far from its New York headquarters, in Los Angeles in 1964, in Chicago in 1965, reserved the current trend even more decisively than Pfizer by convening this time in Carnegie Hall. The entire orchestra and the two tiers of boxes were completely filled with stockholders, about 2,300 of them, of whom a strikingly larger proportion than at any of my other meetings was male. Mrs. Soss and Mrs. Davis were on hand, though, along with Lewis Gilbert and some professional stockholders I hadn't seen before. And, as with Pfizer, the company's whole board of directors sat on the platform, with the chief centers of attraction, in RCA's case, were David Sarnoff, the company's 75-year-old chairman, and his 48-year-old son, Robert W. Sarnoff, who had been its president since the beginning of the year. For me, two aspects of the RCA meeting stood out. The evident respect, amounting almost to veneration, of the stockholders for their celebrated chairman, and an unaccustomed disposition of the amateur stockholders to speak up for themselves. The elder Mr. Sarnoff, looking hale and ready for anything, conducted the meeting. And he and several other RCA executives gave reports on company operations and prospects, in the course of which the words record and growth recurred so monotonously that I, not being an RCA stockholder, began to nod. I was brought wide awake with a jolt on one occasion, though, when I heard Walter D. Scott, chairman of RCA's subsidiary, the National Broadcasting Company, say in connection with his network's television programming that creative resources are always running ahead of demand. No one objected to that statement, or to anything else in the glowing reports. But when they were over, the stockholders had their say on other matters. Mr. Gilbert raised some favorite questions of his about accounting procedures, and a representative of RCA's accountants, Arthur Young and Company, made replies that seemed to satisfy Mr. Gilbert. A Dickensian elderly lady, who identified herself as Mrs. Martha Brand, and said she held many thousands of shares of RCA stock, expressed the view that the accounting procedures of the company should not even be questioned. I have since learned that Mrs. Brand is a professional stockholder who is an anomaly within the profession in that she leans strongly toward the management view of things. Mr. Gilbert then advanced a proposal for the adoption of cumulative voting, supporting it with about the same arguments that Mrs. Soss had used at the GE meeting. Mr. Sarnoff opposed the motion, and so did Mrs. Brand, who explained that she was sure the present directors always worked tirelessly for the welfare of the corporation, and added this time that she was the holder of many, many thousands of shares. Two or three other stockholders spoke up in favor of cumulative voting, the only occasion at any meeting on which I saw stockholders not easily identifiable as professionals speak in dissent on a matter of substance. Cumulative voting was defeated, 95.3% to 4.7%. Mrs. Soss, still in as mild a mood as in Atlanta, said she was delighted to see a woman, Mrs. Josephine Young Case, sitting on the stage as a member of the RCA board, but deplored the fact that Mrs. Case's principal occupation was given on the proxy statement as housewife. Couldn't a woman who was chairman of the board of Skidmore College at least be called a home executive? Another lady stockholder set off a round of applause by delivering a paean to Chairman Sarnoff, whom she called the marvelous Cinderella man of the 20th century. Mrs. Davis, who had earlier objected to the sight of the meeting on the ground, which I found dumbfounding, that Carnegie Hall was too unsophisticated for RCA, advanced a resolution calling for company action to ensure that hereafter no person shall serve as a director after he shall have attained the age of 72. Even though similar rulings are in effect in many companies, and even though the proposal, not being retroactive, would have no effect upon Mr. Sarnoff's status, it seemed to be aimed at him. And thus Mrs. Davis demonstrated again her uncanny knack of playing into management's hands. Nor did she appear to help her cause by putting on a Batman mask, the symbolism of which I didn't grasp when she made it. At all events, the proposal gave rise to several impassioned defenses of Mr. Sarnoff, and one of the speakers went on to complain bitterly that Mrs. Davis was insulting the intelligence of everyone present. At this, the serious-minded Mr. Gilbert leaped up to say, "I quite agree about the silliness of her costume, but there is a valid principle in her proposal." In making this Voltairean distinction, Mr. Gilbert, to judge from his evident state of agitation, was achieving a triumph of reason over inclination that was costing him plenty. Mrs. Davis's resolution was defeated overwhelmingly. The margin against it served to end the meeting with what amounted to a rousing vote of confidence in the Cinderella man. Classic farce, with elements of slapstick, was the dominant mood of the meeting of the Communications Satellite Corporation, with which I wound up my meeting-going season. COMSAT is, of course, the glamorous space-age communications company that was set up by the government in 1963 and turned over to public ownership in a celebrated stock sale in 1964. Upon arriving at the meeting site, the Shoreham Hotel in Washington, I was scarcely startled to discover Mrs. Davis, Mrs. Soss, and Lewis Gilbert among the thousand or so stockholders present. Mrs. Davis, decked out in stage makeup, an orange pith helmet, a short red skirt, white boots, and a black sweater, bearing in white letters the legend, "I was born to raise hell," had planted herself squarely in front of a battery of television cameras. Mrs. Soss, as I had learned by now was her custom, had taken a place at the opposite side of the room from Mrs. Davis, and this meant that she was now as far as possible from the television cameras. Considering that Mrs. Soss does not ordinarily seem to be averse to being photographed, I could write down this choice of seat only as a hard-won triumph of conscience akin to Mr. Gilbert's at Carnegie Hall. As for Mr. Gilbert, he took a place not far from Mrs. Soss, and thus, of course, a long way from Mrs. Davis. Since the previous year, Leo D. Welch, the man who had conducted the 1965 ComSat meeting with such a firm hand, has been replaced as chairman of the company by James McCormick, a West Point graduate, former Rhodes Scholar, and retired Air Force general, with an impeccably polished manner, who bears a certain resemblance to the Duke of Windsor. And Mr. McCormick was conducting this year's session. He warmed up with some preliminary remarks, in the course of which he noted, smoothly, but not without emphasis, that as for the subject of any intervention that a stockholder might choose to make, the field of relevance is quite narrow. When Mr. McCormick had finished his warm-up, Mrs. Soss made a brief speech that may or may not have come within the field of relevance. I missed most of it because the floor microphone supplied to her wasn't working right. Mrs. Davis then claimed the floor, and her mic was working all too well. As the cameras ground, she launched into an ear-splitting tirade against the company and its directors because there had been a special door to the meeting room reserved for the entrance of distinguished guests. Mrs. Davis, in a good many words, said she considered this procedure undemocratic. "We apologize, and when you go out, please go by any door you want," Mr. McCormick said. But Mrs. Davis, clearly unappeased, went on speaking. And now the mood of farce was heightened when it became clear that the Soss-Gilbert faction had decided to abandon all efforts to keep ranks closed with Mrs. Davis. Near the height of her oration, Mr. Gilbert, looking as outraged as a boy whose ball game is being spoiled by a player who doesn't know the rules or care about the game, got up and began shouting, "Point of order, point of order." But Mr. McCormick spurned this offer of parliamentary help. He ruled Mr. Gilbert's point of order out of order and bade Mrs. Davis proceed. I had no trouble deducing why he did this. There were unmistakable signs that he, unlike any other corporate chairman I had seen in action, was enjoying every minute of the goings-on. Through most of the meeting, and especially when the professional stockholders had the floor, Mr. McCormick wore the dreamy smile of a wholly bemused spectator. Eventually, Mrs. Davis's speech built up to a peak of both volume and content, at which she began making specific allegations against individual ComSat directors. And at this point, three security guards, two beefy men and a determined-looking woman, all dressed in gaudy bottle-green uniforms that might have been costumes for the Pirates of Penzance, appeared at the rear, marched with brisk yet stately tread up the center aisle, and assumed the position of parade rest in the aisle within handy reach of Mrs. Davis. Whereupon, she abruptly concluded her speech and sat down. "All right," Mr. McCormick said, still grinning. "Everything's cool now." The guards retired, and the meeting proceeded. Mr. McCormick and the ComSat president, Joseph V. Cherrick, gave the sort of glowing report on the company that I had grown accustomed to, Mr. McCormick going so far as to say that ComSat might start showing its first profit the following year rather than in 1969 as originally forecast. It did. Mr. Gilbert asked what fee, apart from his regular salary, Mr. McCormick received for attending directors' meetings. Mr. McCormick replied that he got no fee. And when Mr. Gilbert said, "I'm glad you get nothing, I approve of that," everybody laughed, and Mr. McCormick grinned more broadly than ever. Mr. Gilbert was clearly trying to make what he considered to be a serious point, but this didn't seem to be the day for that sort of thing. Mrs. Soss took a dig at Mrs. Davis by saying pointedly that anyone who opposed Mr. McCormick as company chairman was lacking in perspicacity. She did note, however, that she couldn't quite bring herself to vote for Mr. Welch, the former chairman, who was now a candidate for the board, inasmuch as he had ordered her thrown out last year. A peppy old gentleman said that he thought the company was doing fine, and everyone should have faith in it. Once, when Mr. Gilbert said something that Mrs. Davis didn't like, and Mrs. Davis, without waiting to be recognized, began shouting her objection across the room, Mr. McCormick gave a short, irrepressible giggle. That single falsetto syllable, magnificently amplified by the chairman's microphone, was the motif of the ComSat meeting. On the plane returning from Washington, as I was musing on the meetings I had attended, it occurred to me that if there had been no professional stockholders at them, I would probably have learned almost as much as I did about the company's affairs, but that I would have learned a good deal less about their chief executives' personalities. It had, after all, been the questions, interruptions, and speeches of the professional stockholders that brought the companies to life, in a sense, by forcing each chairman to shed his official portrait-by-Bachrock mask and engage in a human relationship. More often than not, this had been the hardly satisfactory human relationship of nagger and nagged, but anyone looking for humanity in high corporate affairs can't afford to pick and choose. Still, some doubts remained. Being 30,000 feet up in the air is conducive to taking the broader view, and doing so, as we winged over Philadelphia, I concluded that, on the basis of what I had seen and heard, both company managements and stockholders might well consider a lesson King Lear learned. That when the role of dissenter is left to the fool, there may be trouble ahead for everybody. Chapter 11. One Free Bite. Among the thousands of young scientists who were doing very well in the research and development programs of American companies in the fall of 1962 was one named Donald W. Wolgamuth, who was working for the B.F. Goodrich Company in Akron, Ohio. A 1954 graduate of the University of Michigan, where he had taken the degree of Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering, he had gone directly from the university to a job in the chemical laboratories of Goodrich, at a starting salary of $365 a month. Since then, except for 2 years spent in the Army, he had worked continuously for Goodrich, in various engineering and research capacities, and had received a total of 15 salary increases over the 6.5 years. In November 1962, as he approached his 31st birthday, he was earning $10,644 a year. A tall, self-contained, serious-looking man of German ancestry, whose horn-rimmed glasses gave him an owlish expression, Wolgamuth lived in a ranch house in Wadsworth, a suburb of Akron, with his wife and their 15-month-old daughter. All in all, he seemed to be the young American homme moyen réussi, to the point of boredom. What was decidedly not routine about him, though, was the nature of his job. He was the manager of Goodrich's Department of Space Suit Engineering, and over the past years, in the process of working his way up to that position, he had had a considerable part in the designing and construction of the suits worn by our Mercury astronauts on their orbital and suborbital flights. Then, in the first week of November, Wolgamuth got a phone call from an employment agent in New York who informed him that the executives of a large company in Dover, Delaware, were most anxious to talk to him about the possibility of his taking a job with them. Despite the caller's reticence, a trait common among employment agents making first approaches to prospective employees, Wolgamuth instantly knew the identity of the large company. The International Latex Corporation, which is best known to the public as a maker of girdles and brassieres, but which Wolgamuth knew to be also one of Goodrich's three major competitors in the spacesuit field, is situated in Dover. He knew further that Latex had recently been awarded a subcontract, amounting to some $750,000, to do research and development on spacesuits for the Apollo or Man on the Moon project. As a matter of fact, Latex had won this contract in competition with Goodrich, among others, and was thus, for the moment, much the hottest company in the spacesuit field. On top of that, Wohlgemuth was somewhat discontented with his situation at Goodrich. For one thing, his salary. However bountiful it might seem to many 30-year-olds, was considerably below the average for Goodrich employees of his rank. And, for another, he had been turned down not long before by the company authorities when he asked for air conditioning or filtering to keep dust out of the plant area allocated to spacesuit work. Accordingly, after making arrangements by phone with the executives mentioned by the employment agent, and they did indeed prove to be Latex men, Wohlgemuth went to Dover the following Sunday. He stayed there a day and a half, borrowing Monday from vacation time that was due him from Goodrich, and getting what he subsequently described as a real red carpet treatment. He was taken on a tour of the Latex spacesuit development facilities by Leonard Shepard, director of the company's Industrial Products Division. He was entertained at the home of Max Feller, a Latex vice president. He was shown the Dover housing situation by another company executive. Finally, before lunch on Monday, he had a talk with all three of the Latex executives, following which, as Wohlgemuth later described the scene in court, the three removed themselves to another room for approximately 10 minutes. When they reappeared, one of them offered Wohlgemuth the position of manager of engineering for the Industrial Products Division, which included responsibility for spacesuit development at an annual salary of $13,700, effective at the beginning of December. After getting his wife's approval by telephone, and it was not hard to get, since she was originally from Baltimore and was delighted at the prospect of moving back to her own part of the world, Wohlgemuth accepted. He flew back to Akron that night. First thing Tuesday morning, Wohlgemuth confronted Carl Effler, his immediate boss at Goodrich, with the news that he was quitting at the end of the month to take another job. "Are you kidding?" Effler asked. "No, I am not," Wohlgemuth replied. Following this crisp exchange, which Wohlgemuth later reported in court, Effler, in the time-honored tradition of bereaved bosses, grumbled a bit about the difficulty of finding a qualified replacement before the end of the month. Wohlgemuth spent the rest of the day putting his department's papers in order and clearing his desk of unfinished business. And the next morning, he went to see Wayne Galloway, a Goodrich spacesuit executive with whom he had worked closely and had been on the friendliest of terms for a long time. He said later that he felt he owed it to Galloway to explain to him my side of the picture, in person, even though at the moment he was not under Galloway's supervision in the company chain of command. Wohlgemuth began this interview by rather melodramatically handing Galloway a lapel pin in the form of a Mercury capsule, which had been awarded to him for his work on the Mercury space suits. Now, he said, he felt he was no longer entitled to wear it. "Why then," Galloway asked, "was he leaving?" "Simple enough," Wohlgemuth said. "He considered the Latex offer a step up both in salary and in responsibility." Galloway replied that in making the move, Wohlgemuth would be taking to Latex certain things that did not belong to him. Specifically, knowledge of the processes that Goodrich used in making spacesuits. In the course of the conversation, Wohlgemuth asked Galloway what he would do if he were to receive a similar offer. Galloway replied that he didn't know. For that matter, he added, he didn't know what he would do if he were approached by a group who had a foolproof plan for robbing a bank. Wohlgemuth had to base his decision on loyalty and ethics, Galloway said, a remark that Wohlgemuth took as an accusation of bad faith. He lost his temper, he later explained, and gave Galloway a rash answer. Loyalty and ethics have their price, and International Latex has paid it. he said. After that, the fat was in the fire. Later in the morning, Effler called Wolgamuth into his office and told him it had been decided that he should leave the Goodrich premises as soon as possible, staying around only long enough to make a list of projects that were pending and to go through certain other formalities. In mid-afternoon, while Wolgamuth was occupied with these tasks, Galloway called him and told him that the Goodrich legal department wanted to see him. In the legal department, he was asked whether he intended to use confidential information belonging to Goodrich on behalf of Latex. According to the subsequent affidavit of a Goodrich lawyer, he replied, again rashly, "How are you going to prove it?" He was then advised that he was not legally free to make the move to Latex. While he was not bound to Goodrich by the kind of contract common in American industry, in which an employee agrees not to do similar work for any competing company for a stated period of time, he had, on his return from the Army, signed a routine paper agreeing to keep confidential all information, records, and documents of the company of which I may have knowledge because of my employment. Something Wolgamuth had entirely forgotten until the Goodrich lawyer reminded him. Even if he had not made that agreement, the lawyer told him now, he would be prevented from going to work on spacesuits for Latex by established principles of trade secrets law. Moreover, if he persisted in his plan, Goodrich might sue him. Wolgamuth returned to his office and put in a call to Feller, the Latex vice president he had met in Dover. While he was waiting for the call to be completed, he talked with Effler, who had come in to see him, and whose attitude toward his defection seemed to have stiffened considerably. Wolgamuth complained that he felt at the mercy of Goodrich, which it seemed to him was unreasonably blocking his freedom of action, and Effler upset him further by saying that what had happened during the past 48 hours could not be forgotten and might well affect his future with Goodrich. Wolgamuth, it appeared, might be sued if he left and scorned if he didn't leave. When the Dover call came through, Wolgamuth told Feller that in view of the new situation, he would be unable to go to work for Latex. That evening, however, Wolgamuth's prospects seemed to take a turn for the better. Home in Wadsworth, he called the family dentist, and the dentist recommended a local lawyer. Wolgamuth told his story to the lawyer, who thereupon consulted another lawyer by phone. The two counselors agreed that Goodrich was probably bluffing and would not really sue Wolgamuth if he went to Latex. The next morning, Thursday, officials of Latex called him back to assure him that their firm would bear his legal expenses in the event of a lawsuit, and furthermore, would indemnify him against any salary losses. Thus emboldened, Wolgamuth delivered two messages within the next couple of hours, one in person and one by phone. He told Effler what the two lawyers had told him, and he called the legal department to report that he had now changed his mind and was going to work at International Latex after all. Later that day, after completing the cleanup job in his office, he left the Goodrich premises for good, taking with him no documents. The following day, Friday, R.G. Jeter, general counsel of Goodrich, telephoned Emerson P. Barrett, director of industrial relations for Latex, and spoke of Goodrich's concern for its trade secrets if Wolgamuth went to work there. Barrett replied that although the work for which Wolgamuth was hired was design and construction of spacesuits, Latex was not interested in learning any Goodrich trade secrets, but was only interested in securing the general professional abilities of Mr. Wolgamuth. That this answer did not satisfy Jeter or Goodrich became manifest the following Monday. That evening, while Wolgamuth was in an Akron restaurant called the Brown Derby, attending a farewell dinner in his honor, given by 40 or 50 of his friends, a waitress told him that there was a man outside who wanted to see him. The man was a deputy sheriff of Summit County, of which Akron is the seat, and when Wolgamuth came out, the man handed him two papers. One was a summons to appear in the Court of Common Pleas on a date a week or so off. The other was a copy of a petition that had been filed in the same court that day by Goodrich, praying that Wilgamoth be permanently enjoined from, among other things, disclosing to any unauthorized person any trade secrets belonging to Goodrich and performing any work for any corporation other than plaintiff relating to the design, manufacture, and or sale of high-altitude pressure suits, spacesuits, and or similar protective garments. The need for the protection of trade secrets was fully recognized in the Middle Ages, when they were so jealously guarded by the craft guilds that the guild's employees were rigorously prevented from changing jobs. Laissez-faire industrial society, since it emphasizes the principle that the individual is entitled to rise in the world by taking the best opportunity he is offered, has been far more lenient about job jumping. But the right of an organization to keep its secrets has survived. In American law, the basic commandment on the subject was laid down by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in connection with the 1905 Chicago case. Holmes wrote, "The plaintiff has the right to keep the work which it has done or paid for doing to itself. The fact that others might do similar work, if they wished, does not authorize them to steal plaintiffs." This admirably downright, if not highly sophisticated, U case has been cited in almost every trade secrets case that has come up since. But over the years, as both scientific research and industrial organization have become infinitely more complex, so have the questions of what exactly constitutes a trade secret and what constitutes stealing it. The American Law Institute's Restatement of the Law of Torts, an authoritative text issued in 1939, grapples manfully with the first question by stating or restating that a trade secret may consist of any formula, pattern, device, or compilation of information which is used in one's business and which gives him an opportunity to obtain an advantage over competitors who do not know or use it. But in a case heard in 1952, an Ohio court decided that the Arthur Murray method of teaching dancing, though it was unique and was presumably helpful in luring customers away from competitors, was not a trade secret. All of us have our method of doing a million things. Our method of combing our hair, shining our shoes, mowing our lawn. The court mused and concluded that a trade secret must not only be unique and commercially helpful, but also have inherent value. As for what constitutes thievery of trade secrets, in a proceeding heard in Michigan in 1939, in which the Dutch Cookie Machine Company complained that one of its former employees was threatening to use its highly classified methods to make cookie machines on his own, the trial court decided that there were no fewer than three secret processes by which Dutch cookie machines were made, and enjoined the former employee from using them in any manner. However, the Michigan Supreme Court, on appeal, found that the defendant, although he knew the three secrets, did not plan to use them in his own operations, and accordingly, it reversed the lower court's decision and vacated the injunction. And so on. Outraged dancing teachers, cookie machine manufacturers, and others have made their way through American courts, and the principles of law regarding the protection of trade secrets have become well established. Any difficulty arises chiefly in the application of these principles to individual cases. The number of such cases has been rising sharply in recent years, as research and development by private industry have expanded, and a good index to the rate of such expansion is the fact that $11.5 billion was spent in this work in 1962. More than three times the figure for 1953. No company wants to see the discoveries produced by all that money go out of its doors in the attaché cases, or even in the heads of young scientists bound for greener pastures. In 19th century America, the builder of a better mousetrap was supposed to have been a sinecure, provided, of course, that the mousetrap was properly patented. In those days of comparatively simple technology, patents covered most proprietary rights in business, so trade secrets cases were rare. The better mousetraps of today, however, like the processes involved in outfitting a man to go into orbit or to the moon, are often unpatentable. Since thousands of scientists and billions of dollars might be affected by the results of the trial of Goodrich v. Wolgamuth, it naturally attracted an unusual amount of public attention. In Akron, the court proceedings were much discussed, both in a local paper, the Beacon Journal, and in conversation. Goodrich is an old-line company with a strong streak of paternalism in its relations with its employees, and with strong feelings about what it regards as business ethics. We were exceptionally upset by what Wolgamuth did, a Goodrich executive of long standing said recently. In my judgment, the episode caused more concern to the company than anything that has happened in years. In fact, in the 93 years that Goodrich has been in business, we had never before entered a suit to restrain a former employee from disclosing trade secrets. Of course, many employees in sensitive positions have left us, but in those cases, the companies doing the hiring have recognized their responsibilities. On one occasion, a Goodrich chemist went to work for another company under circumstances that made it appear to us that he was going to use our methods. We talked to the man, and to his new employer, too. The upshot was that the competing company never brought out the product it had hired our man to work on. That was responsible conduct on the part of both employee and company. As for the Wolgamuth case, the local community and our employees were a bit hostile toward us at first, a big company suing a little guy, and so on, but they gradually came around to our point of view. Interest outside Akron, which was evidenced by a small flood of letters of inquiry about the case addressed to the Goodrich legal department, made it clear that Goodrich v. Wolgamuth was being watched as a bellwether. Some inquiries were from companies that had similar problems, or anticipated having them, and a surprising number were from relatives of young scientists asking, "Does this mean my boy is stuck in his present job for the rest of his life?" In truth, an important issue was at stake, and pitfalls awaited the judge who heard the case, no matter which way he decided. On one side was the danger that discoveries made in the course of corporate research might become unprotectable, a situation that would eventually lead to the drying up of private research funds. On the other side was the danger that thousands of scientists might, through their very ability and ingenuity, find themselves permanently locked in a deplorable and possibly unconstitutional kind of intellectual servitude. They would be barred from changing jobs because they knew too much. The trial, held in Akron, presided over by Judge Frank H. Harvey, and conducted, like all proceedings of its type, without a jury, began on November 26th and continued through December 12th, with a week's recess in the middle. Wolgamuth, who was supposed to have started work at Latex on December 3rd, remained in Akron under a voluntary agreement with the court, and testified extensively in his own defense. Injunction, the form of relief that was sought by Goodrich, and the chief form of relief that is available to anyone whose secrets have been stolen, is a remedy that originated in Roman law. It was anciently called interdict, and is still so called in Scotland. What Goodrich was asking, in effect, was that the court issue a direct order to Wolgamuth, not only forbidding him to reveal Goodrich's secrets, but also forbidding him to take employment in any other company's spacesuit department. Any violation of such an order would be contempt of court, punishable by a fine or imprisonment, or both. Just how seriously Goodrich viewed the case became clear when its team of lawyers proved to be headed by Jeter himself, who, as vice president, secretary, the company's ultimate authority on patent law, general law, employee relations, union relations, and workmen's compensation, and Lord High practically everything else, had not found time to try a case in court himself for 10 years. The chief defense counsel was Richard A. Chenoweth, of the Akron Law Firm of Buckingham, Doolittle, and Burroughs, which Latex, though it was not a defendant in the action, had retained to handle the case in fulfillment of its promise to Wilgamoth. From the outset, the two sides recognized that if Goodrich was to prevail, it had to prove, first, that it possessed trade secrets, second, that Wilgamoth also possessed them, and that a substantial peril of disclosure existed, and third, that it would suffer irreparable injury if injunctive relief was not granted. On the first point, Goodrich attorneys, through their questioning of Effler, Galloway, and one other company employee, set out to establish that Goodrich had a number of unassailable spacesuit secrets, among them a way of making the hard shell of a space helmet, a way of making the visor seal, a way of making a sock ending, a way of making the inner liner of gloves, a way of fastening the helmet onto the rest of the suit, and a way of applying a wear-resistant material called neoprene to two-way stretch fabric. Wilgamoth, through his counsel's cross-examinations, sought to show that none of these processes were secrets at all. For example, in the case of the neoprene process, which Effler had described as a very critical trade secret of Goodrich, defense counsel brought out evidence that a latex product that is neither secret nor intended to be worn in outer space, the Playtex Golden Girdle, was made of two-way stretch fabric with neoprene applied to it. And to emphasize the point, Chenoweth introduced a Playtex Golden Girdle for all to see. Nor did either side neglect to bring into court a spacesuit, in each instance inhabited. The Goodrich suit, a 1961 model, was intended to demonstrate what the company had achieved by means of research, research that it did not want to see compromised through the loss of its secrets. The latex suit, also a 1961 model, was intended to show that latex was already ahead of Goodrich in spacesuit development and would therefore have no interest in stealing Goodrich secrets. The latex suit was particularly bizarre-looking, and the latex employee who wore it in court looked almost excruciatingly uncomfortable, as if he were unaccustomed to the air of Earth or of Akron. His air tubes weren't hooked up, and he was hot, the Beacon Journal explained next day. At any rate, after he had sat suffering for 10 or 15 minutes while defense counsel questioned a witness about his costume, he suddenly pointed in an agonized way to his head, and the court record of what followed, probably unique in the annals of jurisprudence, reads like this. Man in the spacesuit. May I take this off? Helmet. The court. All right. The second element in Goodrich's burden of proof, that Wilgamoth was privy to Goodrich secrets, was fairly quickly dealt with because Wilgamoth's lawyers conceded that hardly anything the company knew about spacesuits had been kept from him. They based their defense on, first, the unquestioned fact that he had taken no papers away with him, and second, the unlikelihood that he would be able to remember the details of complex scientific processes, even if he wanted to. On the third element, the matter of irreparable injury, Jeter pointed out that Goodrich, which had made the first full-pressure flying suit in history for the late Wiley Post's high-altitude experiments in 1934, and which had since poured vast sums into spacesuit research and development, was the unquestioned pioneer, and had, up to then, been considered the leader in the field. He tried to paint latex, which had been making full-pressure suits only since the mid-50s, as a parvenu, with the nefarious plan of cashing in on Goodrich's years of research by hiring Wilgamoth. Even if the intentions of Latex and Wilgamoth were the best in the world, Jeter contended, Wilgamoth would inevitably reveal Goodrich secrets in the course of working in Latex's spacesuit department. In any event, Jeter was unwilling to assume good intentions. As evidence of bad ones, there was, on the part of Latex, the fact that the firm had deliberately sought out Wilgamoth, and, on the part of Wilgamoth, the statement he had made to Galloway about the price of loyalty and ethics. The defense disputed the contention that a disclosure of secrets would be inevitable, and of course denied evil intentions on anyone's part. It rounded out its case with a statement made in court under oath by Wilgamoth. I will not reveal to International Latex any items which, in my own mind, I would consider to be trade secrets of the B.F. Goodrich Company. This, of course, was cold comfort to Goodrich. Having heard the evidence and the lawyer's summations, Judge Harvey reserved decision until a later date and issued an order temporarily forbidding Wilgamoth to reveal the alleged secrets or to work in the Latex spacesuit program. He could go on the Latex payroll, but he had to stay out of spacesuits until the court's decision was handed down. In mid-December, Wilgamoth, leaving his family behind, went to Dover and began working for Latex on other products. Early in January, by which time he had succeeded in selling his house in Wadsworth and buying one in Dover, his family joined him at his new stand. In Akron, meanwhile, the lawyers had at each other in briefs intended to sway Judge Harvey. Various fine points of law were debated, learnedly but inconclusively. Yet as the briefs wore on, it became increasingly clear that the essence of the case was quite simple. For all practical purposes, there was no controversy over the facts. What remained in controversy was the answers to two questions. First, should a man be formally restrained from revealing trade secrets when he has not yet committed any such act, and when it is not clear that he intends to? And secondly, should a man be prevented from taking a job simply because the job presents him with unique temptations to break the law? Having scoured the law books, counsel for the defense found exactly the text quotation they wanted in support of the argument that both questions should be answered in the negative. Unlike the decisions of other courts, the general statements of the authors of law textbooks have no official standing in any court. But by using them judiciously, an advocate can express his own opinions in someone else's words and buttress them with bibliographical references. The quotation was from a text entitled Trade Secrets, which was written by a lawyer named Ridsdale Ellis and published in 1953, and it read in part, "Usually it is not until there is evidence that the employee, who has changed jobs, has not lived up to his contract, expressed or implied, to maintain secrecy, that the former employer can take action. In the law of torts, there is the maxim, every dog has one free bite. A dog cannot be presumed to be vicious until he has proved that he is by biting someone. As with a dog, the former employer may have to wait for a former employee to commit some overt act before he can act." To counter this doctrine, which, besides being picturesque, appeared to have a crushingly exact applicability to the case under dispute, Goodrich's lawyers came up with a quotation of their own from the very same book. Ellis on Trade Secrets, as the lawyers referred to it in their briefs, was repeatedly used by the two sides to belabor each other, for the good reason that it was the only text on the subject available in the Summit County Law Library, where both sides did the bulk of their research. In support of their cause, Goodrich counsel found that Ellis had said, in connection with trade secrets cases in which the defendant was a company accused of luring away another company's confidential employee, where the confidential employee left to enter defendant's employment, an inference can be drawn to supplement other circumstantial evidence that the latter employment was stimulated by a desire by the defendant to learn plaintiff's secrets. In other words, Ellis apparently felt that when the circumstances look suspicious, one free bite is not permitted. Whether he contradicted himself or merely refined his position is a nice question. Ellis himself had died several years earlier, so it was not possible to consult him on the matter. On February 20, 1963, having studied the briefs and deliberated on them, Judge Harvey delivered his decision, in the form of a 9-page essay fraught with suspense. To begin with, the judge wrote, he was convinced that Goodrich did have trade secrets relative to spacesuits, and that Wilgemuth might be able to remember, and therefore be able to disclose some of them to Latex, to the irreparable injury of Goodrich. He declared further that there isn't any doubt that the Latex Company was attempting to gain Wilgemuth's valuable experience in this particular specialized field for the reason that they had this so-called Apollo contract with the government. And there isn't any doubt that if he is permitted to work in the spacesuit division of the Latex Company, he would have an opportunity to disclose confidential information of the B.F. Goodrich Company. Still further, Judge Harvey was convinced by the attitude of Latex, as this was evidenced by the conduct of its representatives in court, that the company intended to try to get Wilgemuth to give it the benefit of every kind of information he had. At this point in the opinion, things certainly looked black for the defense. However, and the judge was well down page 6 before he got to the however, what he had concluded after studying the one free bite controversy among the lawyers was that an injunction cannot be issued against disclosure of trade secrets before such disclosure has occurred, unless there is clear and substantial evidence of evil intent on the part of the defendant. The defendant in this case, the judge pointed out, was Wilgemuth, and if any evil intent was involved, it appeared to be attributable to Latex rather than to him. For this reason, along with some technical ones, he wound up, it is the view and the order of this court that injunction be denied against the defendant. Goodrich promptly appealed the decision, and the Summit County Court of Appeals, pending its own decision on the case, issued another restraining order, which differed from Judge Harvey's in that it permitted Wilgemuth to do spacesuit work for Latex, but still forbade him to disclose Goodrich's alleged trade secrets. Accordingly, Wilgemuth, with an initial victory under his belt but with a new legal struggle on his behalf ahead, went to work in the Latex moonsuit shop. Jeter and his colleagues, in their brief to the Court of Appeals, stated unequivocally that Judge Harvey had been wrong, not only in some of the technical aspects of his decision, but in his finding that there must be evidence of bad faith on the defendant's part before an injunction can be granted. The question to be decided is not one of good or bad faith, but rather whether there is a threat or a likelihood that trade secrets will be disclosed, the Goodrich brief declared roundly, and a little inconsistently, in view of all the time and effort the company had expended on attempts to pin bad faith on both Latex and Wilgemuth. Wilgemuth's lawyers, of course, did not fail to point out the inconsistency. It seems strange indeed that Goodrich should find fault with this finding of Judge Harvey, they remarked in their brief. Quite clearly, they had conceived for Judge Harvey feeling so tender as to border on the protective. The decision of the Court of Appeals was handed down on May 22nd. Written by Judge Arthur W. Doyle, with his two colleagues of the court concurring, it was a partial reversal of Judge Harvey. Finding that there exists a present real threat of disclosure, even without actual disclosure, and that an injunction may prevent a future wrong, the court granted an injunction that restrained Wilgemuth from disclosing to Latex any of the processes and information claimed as trade secrets by Goodrich. On the other hand, Judge Doyle wrote, we have no doubt that Wilgemuth had the right to take employment in a competitive business and to use his knowledge other than trade secrets and experience for the benefit of his new employer. Plainly put, Wilgemuth was at last free to accept a permanent job doing space suit work for Latex, provided only that he refrained from disclosing Goodrich secrets in the course of his work. Neither side carried the case above the Summit County Court of Appeals, to the Ohio Supreme Court, and beyond that, to the United States Supreme Court. So with the decision of the appeals court, the Wilgemuth case was settled. Public interest in it subsided soon after the trial was over, but professional interest continued to mount, and of course it mounted still more after the appeals court decision in May. In March, the New York City Bar Association, in collaboration with the American Bar Association, had presented a symposium on trade secrets, with the Wohlgemuth case as its focus. In the later months of that year, employers worried about loss of trade secrets brought numerous suits against former employees, presumably relying on the Wohlgemuth decision as a precedent. A year later, there were more than 24 trade secrets cases pending in the courts. The most publicized of them being the effort of E.I. DuPont de Nemours and Company to prevent one of its former research engineers from taking part in the production of certain rare pigments for the American Potash and Chemical Corporation. It would be logical to suppose that Jeter might be worried about enforcement of the appeals court's order, might be afraid that Wohlgemuth, working behind the locked door of the latex laboratory, and perhaps nursing a grudge against Goodrich, would take his one free bite in spite of the order, on the assumption that he would not be caught. However, Jeter didn't look at things that way. Until, and unless we learn otherwise, we assume that Wohlgemuth and International Latex, both having knowledge of the court order, will comply with the law, Jeter said after the case was concluded. No specific steps by Goodrich to police the enforcement of the order have been taken or are contemplated. However, if it should be violated, there are various ways in which we would be likely to find out. Wohlgemuth, after all, is working with others who come and go. Out of perhaps 25 employees in constant touch with him, it's likely that one or two will leave Latex within a couple of years. Furthermore, you can learn quite a lot from suppliers who deal with both Latex and Goodrich, and also from customers. However, I do not feel that the order will be violated. Wohlgemuth has been through a lawsuit. It was quite an experience for him. He now knows his responsibilities under the law, which he may not have known before. Wohlgemuth himself said late in 1963 that since the conclusion of the case, he had received a great many inquiries from other scientists working in industry. The gist of their questions being, "Does your case mean that I'm married to my job?" He told them that they would have to draw their own conclusions. Wohlgemuth also said that the court order had had no effect on his work in the latex spacesuit department.